Welcome to New World Notes. I am Kenneth Doust. In December 2009, economist Richard Wolff gave a lecture at Brown University. He gave the talk the provocative title, Capitalism Hits the Fan. Just recently, I downloaded and watched it on video. The talk was 2 hours long and brilliant and very useful, and Wolff is a very fine speaker. This week and next, we'll broadcast major portions of the talk. Wolff explains the economic pickle the United States is currently in, the extent of the problem, what the various causes are, what the government is doing about the problem, and what could and should be done, short-term and long-term. So the suspense doesn't get unbearable, I will summarize. It's a big, big problem. Wall Street and the bankers are far from the only culprits. The problem is much bigger than that. The problem will last a long, long time, and there are no quick fixes. Some practical steps could help, just as they helped in the previous Great Depression of the 1930s. For instance, having the government create jobs repairing our infrastructure is such a no-brainer, you'd think that even Congress could figure that step out. A real fix, though, will require major changes in the way that business enterprises are structured and operate. In today's selection, Wolff looks at some causes of our pickle. Those causes that especially involve us working stiffs in the 99%, including productivity, pay, working hours, workforce growth, and consumer debt. They are all interrelated. Next week, we'll focus more on business management, the banks, investors, and other 1% types, plus some concrete suggestions for action. For now, shining the spotlight on the 99%, explaining what hit us and why, here is Professor Richard Wolff.
So we're dealing with a very profound crisis, comparable, as almost everyone admits, to the Great Depression. Not as bad yet, but who knows? How did we get into this? What does it mean? Here we need to do a little history. But I think you'll see when I'm done that it pays to do a little history. We begin with the good news, if you like. An absolutely remarkable thing about the United States that perhaps you've never thought about in this way. From shortly after our emergence as an independent country, shortly after our revolution, we start this date, 1820, and the only reason we start there is that the statistics, which aren't good for 1820, are absolutely ridiculous for any time before then. Okay, so we start with 1820. From 1820 to 1970, 150 years, long time, the following sentence is true. The average level of wages, real wages, what you actually got for an hour's worth of work, rose every decade for 150 years. There's probably no capitalist country in the world that can boast a record like that. It's absolutely stunning and unusual. Even in the Great Depression, real wages went up, because even though people's money wages went down, prices fell even more. So you ended up being able to buy more, even though you had fewer dollars in your pocket at the end, because the prices fell. A real wage simply is a measure of how many goods and services you can actually buy. It adjusts your money wage for the prices you have to pay. So for 150 years, Americans got higher wages. What did this mean? It meant that Americans began to believe, and you know that how deeply that is in our political language, that we lived in a really blessed place. God, if you believe in that, really must like us. Something magical was true about America. You came here, you worked hard, and amazing, you got more. You could imagine to live in your own home. You could even dream at one point of sending your children to college, to have a car all your own, to wear nice clothes. It was amazing. Every family thought that it would live better than the generation before, and the next generation better still. Parents got into the habit of offering their children to provide them with the education and the support that would make them have a better life. And the irony here in the United States, and the marvel, was it was true. Millions of people, the ancestors of most of us in this room, if we're Americans, came to the United States hoping to cash in on this operation, willing to work hard, expecting that their life here would reward them with a higher standard of living than they would have gotten if they'd stayed where they came from, and mostly they were right. And it becomes part of the American culture and the American imagination. This is the place where if you work hard, you get more pay. Yeah, the work may not be pleasant, the work may be difficult, but the reward is at the mall. You'll earn more money and you'll buy more stuff. Try to imagine with me what it would mean to a population that for 150 years internalizes that image, that hope, that expectation, if it were suddenly to stop being true. And I ask you to imagine that because that's what happened. In the 1970s, the rising real wage of the United States came to an end, and it has never resumed. The real wage of the American worker today, the average amount of goods and services you can buy with an hour of your labor, is no greater today than it was in 1978. You may be working harder, you may be working longer, you may be working more efficiently because you're working with a computer and all these other things. And indeed you are. You're delivering many more goods and services per hour of your work to your employer. He's very happy about it. But he doesn't pay you one iota more. This is an astonishing change, a sea change, a dramatic alteration in one's circumstance. It's all the more powerful in our country because it's unspoken. Because in the 1970s or 80s or 90s or to this day, nobody talks about this. No one confronts it. No one asks, why did this happen? What do we do about it? Instead, as good Americans, we pretend it isn't there. We imagine that if it's going on, well, it's just about me and my job and my circumstance rather than a social process. And we imagine that if it's not a social problem, just my particular problem, then I can solve it. And how am I going to solve it? How did the American working class solve the problem? Two things they did, starting in the 1970s and right up until this crisis. And those two things are part of why this crisis happens, which is why I'm going to tell you about them now. The first thing Americans did is conclude, okay, I'm not getting any more wages per hour. I know what, I'll do more hours. Smart move. And not only me, the adult male in the household, but my wife, she's going to go out. She may have been at home, she may have been a housewife, no more of that. She has to go out because we have to sustain the family standard of living rising. And the old people have to come out of retirement and take at least a part-time job, and the teenager ought to do something on Saturdays at least, don't you think? Here's a statistic to think about. The average number of hours worked per year by an American right now, average, is 20% more than the average number of hours worked by a Swedish, French, German, or Italian worker. Think about it. For every 5 hours you work, for every 6 hours you work, they only work five or something like that. Some of you go to Europe and you enjoy lovely dinners with wine in an alfresco setting in some Italian town. And you say to yourself when the dinner is over, these people know how to live. And you imagine that it's a matter of their culture. They just love grapes. It isn't got much to do with culture. What they have is time. They don't work like we do. They have time for long dinners. We are the country that invented fast food. And now you know why. It's a necessity. We don't have time to sit down. We need between jobs to run by one of those takeout windows and yell something at a disconsolate teenager who yells something back and hands you something you shouldn't put in your body in any case. And so Americans went to work, most importantly the women. In 1970, 40% of American women worked outside the home for money. Today, double, 80%. An absolutely fundamental change. Those women had to do that. They may have thought of it as women's liberation, and it certainly had those dimensions. They wanted to help the family. The point, in fact, is if the family was going to continue to consume, to give its children what it had promised, to live the American dream, since husband wasn't going to get any more wages ever again, she had to go out. But when the wife goes out, all kinds of things change. Women in America, housewomen, household women, held together the emotional life of our society. They did the emotional work. They provided the solace. When that woman has to go out and do 8 hours of work and get dressed and do the travel to the job and back home, she can't do it anymore. She may not face that fact, but she can't. Starting in the 1970s, the United States became the country with the highest rate of divorce. The relationships couldn't survive. We have 6% of the population of the world and consume over half the psychotropic drugs, the antidepressants, the tranquil. What's going on? Are we crazy people? I don't think so. I think we are under extraordinary pressure. We work the longest hours on the face of the earth. We do more hours per average worker than the Japanese. That's saying something. And our families are stressed, deeply stressed, as anyone who has studied this situation knows. Our behavior has changed under the pressure of this extra work. And one way to describe it to you is to mention a book some of you may know. A Harvard sociologist named Robert Putnam wrote a famous book with a funny title, Bowling Alone, title of the book. And here's what he does. He studies Americans' participation in anything other than making their life hang together. Bowling leagues used to absorb millions of Americans. No more. Trade unions used to be centers of collective life. No more. Community organizations used to get lots of people. PTAs did too. No more. Americans turned inward in the last 30 years. But it's not some mysterious cultural phenomenon. It has to do with you're working too hard, you're stressed out of your mind, your relationships are falling apart, your intimate life is a disaster. But you don't want to see it in terms of the wages and the job and that's what I'm going to stress. Anyway, did it at least work? Did American families enable themselves to buy more stuff in the way they had hoped to give their kids an education when they worked all the extra hours with extra members of the family doing it? And the answer is no. It turned out that when mother went out to get a job, she needed a second car because we don't have a very good public transportation system, and she needed a second pair of clothes, and when she was too tired to cook, she bought prepared food, and that all cost a lot of money. So the extra money she made was eaten up in an awful lot of extra expenses that were unavoidable, given that she was going to go out and work. And so it didn't work. So the American people, ever resourceful, did something else, which further traumatized them. To keep the consumption going, to deliver the American dream to their children, they went on a borrowing binge, the likes of which no working class in the history of the world ever undertook before. Starting in the 1970s, the American savings rate collapsed. We stopped saving money. But much worse than that, we borrowed money. We invented a new way to give everybody debts. It's called the credit card. Before the 1970s, we didn't have that. Only rich people had an American Express card. After that, we developed the American Express card for the masses. It's called Master and Visa, and you all have them. Many of you have lots of them. You collect them. You max one out, you get another one. And then you get another one. And you keep hoping that this Russian roulette will not get you. And so in 2007, we came to the end of the line for the working class. They couldn't work any more hours. They were exhausted. They were stressed beyond words. And now they were overwhelmed by having violated what their parents had told them. Save money, little boy. Hold something back, little girl, for a difficult time, for a rainy day, for special expenses, for an illness. Not only do we not save anything, but we're in hock up to our ears. Another statistic for you. When the Great Depression began in 1929, the average level of debt of an American family was about 25 to 30% of its annual income. That's what the average family owed. In 2007, the average level of debt of an American family was 125% of its annual income. There is no precedent for an economic downturn of the sort we have when it hits a population as indebted as ours is. One of the reasons nobody knows what's going to happen in this crisis is because we never had one under these circumstances before. But by 2007, it's over. The American working class had postponed coming to terms with the end of rising wages by working itself to the bone, by stressing itself out, and by incurring a level of anxiety about an unsustainable level of debt. The Federal Reserve keeps a statistic. What proportion of your disposable income is used simply to pay your debts? Think of it this way. How much of the money you earn can't be used to buy anything because you have to give it to the lenders who you owe money to? It's now at about 17%. One out of every $6 you earn is not available for you to spend. You just have to pay it in interest and paying back your debts. Not only will Americans be unable to borrow anymore, they can't carry it, but the people who used to lend to the United States working class are not interested in doing it anymore. Some of you will have already discovered that. You're going to get nasty letters from your credit card company announcing to you that you better pay 25, 30% on your credit card, or else you're not going to have a credit card. Your choice. As always in America, freedom of choice. Okay? So the working class is exhausted. It can't carry this. It can't continue. And somewhere in the United States, in all of us, we kind of know it. Can't quite face it, can't quite say it, but we know it. The most incredible change in our cultural form over the last 15 years has been the reemergence of films in which the leading theme is a typhoon, a flood, zombies, vampire. What is this? This notion that forces we cannot control are overtaking and undermining us, that doesn't come out of nowhere. There's a population that needs to express its fears, and that's a safe way of doing it. Let me turn now, as an economist, to the other side of the coin. If the workers have been taking it on the chin, have been experiencing life the way I've just described, how has it been going for the employers? And for those of you that have been hurting under the bad news of what I've been telling you, here's your chance to feel good. For employers, the last 30 years has been the best 30 years in the history of capitalism in the United States. No contest. And the explanation is very simple. Over the whole period from 1820 to 1970, not only did workers' wages go up, but workers' productivity went up. All that that means is the quantity of goods and services that 1 hour of a worker's labor produces for the employer. It went up because workers worked harder, because they were better educated, they had more machines, they had better machines, etc. So for the 150 years, from 1820 to 1970, workers' wages went up, but what they delivered to their employers kept going up, too. In a sense, it was good for everybody. The employer got more and more, and you know how capitalism works. You come at 9, you work, you go home at 5, you leave behind whatever it is you produced, because you can't take that home. If you do, the police will come. So you have to leave that there. You go home. The employer gets it. He sells it, and he keeps the money. So if you're producing more and more per hour for your employer, he's a happy man. He's got more to sell. And over the 150 years from 1820 to 1970, he got more and more from the workers, but he also gave the workers more and more. What happened after 1970 is that changed. The workers kept producing more and more for the employer. That's after all the last 30 years is when we all begin to work with computers, and computers allow us to do a lot more in an hour than we were able to do without a computer. So we keep producing more and more for the employer. Productivity rises. But the employer doesn't give us any more at all. You do not need an advanced degree in economics. And being a professor of economics, I wouldn't advise it anyway. But you don't need it to understand that workers are producing more and more for the employer, but he's not giving them more and more, then the whole benefit of rising productivity accrues to profits. So the people who made out like bandits in the last 30 years were the employers, number one, and whoever could get a piece of the profits the employers were getting. We call those people stock owners, shareholders. People who have a piece of a company can get a piece of the profits the company earns. That's how our system works. So the people who did really well in the last 30 years were the employers and the people who own shares in the companies. They did wonderfully. They were very happy. In 1970, the United States, among all industrial advanced countries, had the most equal distribution of wealth and income. The gap between rich and poor was smaller in the United States than it was in France or Italy or Switzerland or the other countries, or Japan. Today, we are the most unequal. Why? Because the rich took off in the last 30 years. Every statistic I know, and this is agreed to by economists left, right, and center, the distribution of income and wealth in the United States has become much more unequal. It's been a wonderful time to be involved in the stock market. From 1982 to the year 2000, the stock market had a run unparalleled in its history for that many years. Extraordinary. Nothing better illustrates how the society worked than to ask the question, why did the wages stop rising in the 1970s? Given everything I've told you, look how much hangs on that. Why did that happen? There are four basic reasons. The first one was a very important technical change. I referred to it already, the computer. The computer meant that we needed a lot fewer people to do a lot of jobs. Think with me for a minute of a supermarket. It used to be that you had to have an army of people called inventory checkers. They were the people who kept track of how many boxes of Rice Krispies, how many rolls of toilet paper were being sold, and so they would know when to order more to restock the shelves. You don't do that anymore. We don't need those people. Every time you buy a roll of toilet paper, somebody runs it by a little scanning machine that registers on a computer, oh, another toilet paper, gone. And when the little dot comes to turn red, then the one person instead of 50 who stands there mesmerized by that computer screen hits a button and more toilet paper is shipped from the company. So the computer meant, and this is the important thing, much less demand for workers. The second thing that also reduced the demand for workers, the need for workers, was the decision by American corporations not only to substitute computers for workers, but the corporations also decided to move production out of the United States. Big time. Workers in other parts of the world were cheaper. Modern telecommunications made it possible to coordinate with your managers all over the world as quickly as it used to be to walk down the hall and talk to your manager at the end of the corridor. And so America moved production out of the United States massively. A little statistic again, because economists are expected to throw statistics. I don't want to do too much, but a little, just so you remember that I am an economist. 60% of the goods coming into the United States from China are produced by subsidiaries of American corporations. There's a great temptation in this country to talk about the Chinese. Yes, it's Chinese workers who make them. But 60% of what comes in here is produced by American subsidiaries, American companies that are employing Chinese workers in China, because they're a hell of a lot cheaper than American workers here. But if you move jobs out of the country and if you replace workers with machines, you need a lot fewer workers. And that really got going in the 1970s. But that wasn't even all of it. Not only were there fewer jobs, but there were more Americans looking for jobs. Two groups in particular. One I've already mentioned. Women. Massive numbers of women moving into the job market. They wanted to be equal with men. They wanted to have jobs outside the home. They wanted to realize their potential in all the ways that jobs outside the home can do. and many other reasons. But there were many women, millions of them, looking for work. And we also discovered that as the world becomes more unequal, the gap between rich and poor poor people from more and more poor countries think about moving here, as people have for most of the history of the country. So we had women and immigrants flooding in to look for work, just as there were fewer jobs because of technology and export of our jobs. No surprise at all that employers took advantage of this situation, didn't have to raise wages anymore. With these extra people looking for the work, they would have to take the jobs whether you pay them a rising wage or not. And the proof of the pudding is that's what happened. They didn't pay any more wages, and Americans were as desperate for work as they had ever been. The quintessential story comes to this apex. I've been telling you how Americans went on a borrowing binge. Have any of you wondered, where did the money come to lend all those Americans all that money? Who's the lender? What's the source of the money? And if you understand what I'm about to tell you, you'll understand in a nutshell the remarkable quality of our society over the last 30 years. Because the origin of the money lent to the American worker were the extraordinary profits of American business. They had made so much money because the productivity went up when the wages went down that they turned around and used the extra profits that they got by not paying higher wages to lend it to the workers instead. Think of yourself now, and some of you will enjoy this, as if you were a businessman or a businesswoman, an employer. This is as close to nirvana as business gets. Instead of paying your workers higher wages over time as they work harder and better for you, you don't. Instead of paying them more, which is what we did from 1820 to 1970, instead of that, we give them a loan, which they have to give back to us with interest. If I had a portable record machine now, I'd play the national anthem. This is stunning. The only thing more stunning than what is going on is the fact that many of your faces betray that you didn't understand this. And nothing I'm saying is difficult. Nothing I'm saying is complicated. Nothing I'm saying is not described in 1,000 statistical series produced by the United States government every day. And I'll leave it to you to wonder why you never heard this before. What does that tell you about the society in which you live?
Professor Richard Wolff, and a passage from his lecture, Capitalism Hits the Fan. Wolff brilliantly explained some of the changes in the working world that led to the current crisis. Increased productivity, decreasing jobs, growing workforce, stagnant pay, and growing debt. Come back next week for more of Wolff. Meanwhile, check out the links on newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Illegate to my non-carborundum, don't mourn, organize, imagine alternatives, and ciao.